You're listening to Career Chats with Phil Ray Smith, brought to you by Michael Page.
Hello and welcome to the Career Chats podcast, brought to you by recruitment experts Michael Page. Every episode, we talk to someone interesting and unique about how they made it and the life or career lessons learned along the way. We also try to focus on a different skill each time, and our guests offer their advice on how the likes of you or I could make the most of them. You can listen to the Michael Page podcast on the website and on Audioboom, Spotify and iTunes. To make sure you get the next episode as soon as it's available, you can subscribe to Career Chats by hitting the subscribe button in your player. And why wouldn't you? Today's celebrity career advisor is a Yorkshireman, a cricketer, in fact, one of the most successful England test bowlers of all time. He was a key member of the England team who saw victory in the famous Ashes series against Australia in 2005. He is, of course, Matthew Hoggard, MBE. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you.
So let me ask about your career. When was it that you first realised that you were a cricketer and that your job was to play it for a living?
A long time ago, but at the age of 17 I was playing 13 cricket for my local cricket team, and I thought my chance of playing professional cricket was over, so I was doing my A-levels because I wanted to go off and study. And a massive part of luck came into my career in the form of a man called Phil Carrick, an ex-Yorkshire captain, came to Pudsey Kongs, took one look at me in the third team and put me into the first team. And it was a life-changing moment, and it was just a slice of luck that somebody recognised something in me. And from there, it was a fast rise through the Yorkshire ranks and into an England playing shirt. And it didn't really hit me that I wanted to be a rugby player when I grew up. I wanted a bit more manly. But the cricket took over very rapidly and the studying went by the wayside, and I pursued a career in chasing a red leather thing around.
So when people say you make your own luck happen, the fact that you were playing in a team and doing well, I suppose that was crucial, wasn't it? It's getting that experience in the first place.
Yeah, massively. And we talk about teamwork, and cricket's a very individualistic game. It's a team sport, but every one time you're by yourself. So when you're out in the middle batting, nobody else is batting with you. It's all about your batting. Well, I was a bowler, so when I was bowling, there was nobody else that could do anything in that game except for me until I let go of the ball, and then you relied on the team around you to field it. So there's a lot of hard work that goes into the performances, and a lot of hard work to get into a position where you win the game, and that's all about teamwork.
Well, talking of winning the game, I wanted to fast forward a bit quickly to your Ashes victory in 2005. It was the first time in a couple of decades, pretty much, against Australia. What was it like, first of all, to be such an instrumental part of it?
I was going to say 2005 was the icing on the cake. The real work started back in 2002 or 2000. We sat in a room at Lord's and we had a sports psychologist came into us. Because I was in an England team, and we're all in the same coloured clothing, we all had the same kit on, and we all wanted to win a game of cricket. And I always thought that there's only one way of thinking, there's only one way around of doing things and how to win that game, one way of practising, and that was practice hard. And Steve Bull, who is a sports psychologist doing a lot of work with the Olympians, came in and said, right then, how much of this sport is technical and talent and how much of this game is mental? And as an England team, we put about 70% was talent, 30% was mental. And he said, when was the last time you spent any time training your brain? And we thought, well, we don't. So his next question, are you good enough to ignore 30% of your game? And we all sort of went, no. And he had my attention, because before he came in, I thought, what on earth do I want with a sports psychologist? So it wasn't really a psychological look at things. It was how to get the best out of yourself and how to get the best out of your teammates. And we did something called the Myers-Briggs, which is an assassination. It's not an assassination, but it tells you all about your personal indexing and how you want to learn, how you want to perform. And we everybody in the team did it, and we were given animals. So somebody that liked to be very studious and write everything down and be structured was an owl. And we had owls, we had beavers, we had foxes, we had what else? And we also knew if we were introverted and extroverted. So it's all about a learning curve, of not only about yourself, but your teammates. So when the teammate was doing something and you thought, that really annoys me, you actually thought, well, actually, what I'm doing is annoying him. Or the way that the practice was structured, that it was down to the last minute, really annoyed somebody else and it didn't annoy you. So there was a lot of good things that come out of the discussion of which we could work on. And it got me out of that, right, there's only one way sort of system, and knew there was more than what you see on the outside going on in everybody's head.
That's fascinating. And so, you know, it was described as the most thrilling ever. How did you ensure that you didn't get kind of caught up in that excitement? Was it this kind of knowing yourself, or what do you do to avoid nerves on the kind of the crucial moments?
You can't avoid nerves. Nerves are very natural, and they're good if you can harness them in the right way. But again, it's processes. And you look at the processes, you look at the outcome, you get lost in not doing what you're supposed to be doing in the here and now. And that's exactly what we did as a team. We knew that there was our goal. I think the ECB launched a mission statement in 2002 to be the world's number one ranked test team by 2007. So they gave us a goal, they gave us a time frame. They said, right, then this is what we're setting out to go. We know there's going to be ups and downs. We know that there's going to be good times, bad times. We know there's going to be losses around there. But how do we maximise how we go out and perform? We talked about the world's best practice and how to look at who's the best in the world now and then improve on what they're doing, because if you just copy them, you're only going to be as good as them now and they're going to move on. So there was lots of things going on, but the here and now and the processes that stand you in the building blocks of getting that victory and making sure that you don't get carried away. And I was very much, I do get caught up in the moment, and if I do get into a tricky situation, my default is to try harder and sometimes that's counterproductive, because you need to be relaxed, you need to be in control, you need to take deep breath, relax and say, right, then what are my processes to deliver the best ball? And Michael Vaughan, who was the captain at the time, he knew everybody, because we've done the Myers-Briggs by then, he knew his players inside out. So he used to talk to me about nonsense. So I'd bowl a ball and he'd turn around and say, how are the monkeys doing? And I said, well, they're not very good, because one of them fell off a tree and got eaten by the crocodiles in the middle of a test match, bowling at, say, Matthew Hayden, and I'd turn around and bowl. And it just took me away from, there's 30,000 people in this stadium watching you, you've just been hit for four and running in and trying too hard. So he knew to take me away from the here and now, just to get me focused again.
I find that fascinating, because obviously we all encounter flashpoints in our lives, these moments of decision and moments of great impact. Things like job interviews are a good example of them. But to kind of just to take a step back and to kind of get you out of that kind of panicky nervousness, I can see how powerful that would be.
Yeah, and we did the why, the what and the how. So we made little tick boxes, and I wasn't a very organised, I'm a doer, I'm not a thinker. I like to go out and try it myself rather than be told how to do it. But there's little boxes like, what are you going to do? We're going to win the game. How are we going to win the game? We're going to get partnership. We're going to score 400 runs when we're batting. How are we going to score 400 runs? Well, we need two people to get 100, right? How are we going to get 100 while I'm going to face? And you can break down boxes into all the way down into, well, it's important what I go do shopping on a Friday, because I know when I come back on Sunday, the shops will be shut. It'll be late when I get back off the coach. Therefore, it's important I'm going to train. Well, if I want to train on Monday, that I've got something on the fridge. So you can go down into all the detail you want, and when you say stay in the moment, if you tick all the little boxes, it gives you a greater element of success at the end. It doesn't guarantee you success, but it makes sure that you are in the best possible place to be in that, into the leading board.
It goes to show how effortless victory is so much preparation goes into it. Visualization is another thing you mentioned in your book, Welcome to My World. Visualization of success, was that a powerful thing for you?
Yeah, visualization of success, but also I got into a lot of stick with my teammates in India. We were sort of like hotel bound because we had security issues and there was terrorist threats and everything else, so we were sort of like confined to the hotel, and you could go stir crazy. And one of the journalists says, what do you do to fill your time? And how do you? And I said, well, sometimes I take my dogs for a walk. And they went, you what? And I said, well, I take my dogs for, and I'll sit on bed, close my eyes, and I'll take my dogs for a walk, and I'll go back home in my head and go on one of my favourite walks where I know the tree's falling down here, there's a stone in the path there, there's the river running down. And I visualised walking the dogs in my head, and it was like it's like a break that you, if you can get to somewhere in your head, you can then feel refreshed. And it's exactly the same as when you're playing. I used to sit at the end of my mark before a test match started. I'd take my boots off, sit down at the end of my run-up, and be like, who's at the other end? We've lost the toss tomorrow. There's a full house in. Who's at the other end? And I'd plan my over. How does it feel running up? How does it feel coming out of my hands? And it takes away a little bit of nerves. It gives you preparation for tomorrow, because you, even though you're not in the situation, you've thought about the situation. And if you've thought about it or been in a similar situation to one that you find yourself in, you've got a better chance of making the right decision. Clive Woodward talks a lot about it. He talks about teacup and thinking clearly under pressure. If you've already been there and done it, the chances of making the right decision are greater. And that's what I used to do. I used to vision the ball coming out of my hand. How does it feel? How does my action feel? What sort of ball am I bowling to the batsman? And when you then go and you lose a toss tomorrow and you're in front of 30,000 people, you talk about the nerves. Well, actually, I did this yesterday. So it's not, so you help calm them nerves, you help keep clearly, thinking clearly under pressure, you help just maintain that the here and now situation.
And it paid off mightily in the Ashes in 2005. I just wanted to, while we're still talking about the Ashes, I'd love to know a little bit more about the day after the victory.
so do I. I forgot.
I was going to say, there was a famous open-top bus tour. I believe there was a visit to Downing Street, and I seem to remember you were all a bit worse for wear.
We were very much worse. Well, to be fair, we were still in wear, because we, being the first time in 20 years, we were still on terrestrial TV. There was no other major sporting events on, and we were the front pages, back pages, middle pages of all the newspaper on. Everybody was talking about it. And when you've won the series and the pressure's off, we decided to let our hire down a little bit. And so we were still a little bit worse for wear, as you said, when we went down for breakfast, and they put champagne breakfast on. So we just topped up a little bit. And you're right, we saw the Lord Mayor of London. We went to Trafalgar Square. We went to the Prime Minister. We went to 10 Downing Street. And it was amazing how many people came out to see a cricket team go around London. We were scared that it was only going to be one man and his dog, but it was unbelievable. And it just showed how much impact it had on the population in general.
Now, you're also known as a bit of a joker. I read about the day that you spent the whole time making chicken noises. Was this another one of these distraction techniques, or was it just to be annoying? Because I think it was Nasser Hussain, you know, he was known for being a bit of disciplinarian. I don't know if that one particularly riled him that much, but did you ever find yourself thinking, I need to be a bit more professional for the sake of my career?
No, in sporting terms, but yes, after retiring. Because you've got a persona of being a bit of a clown and a bit of a joker, then when you're in the business world and you want people to take you seriously, they only see what they see on TV or see on the sports field. They don't see you as a serious businessman. They see you as a bit of a laugh of the joker that was always messing around. So the transition from sort of like the playing fields into the offices, yes, I found it difficult for people to take me seriously, and it's still work in progress because everybody just sees the public persona.
And you mentioned kind of your second act there, if I may be so bold to put it that way, and it's often a thing that sports people encounter, which is, I've had my playing career, what do I do next? And although that's obviously a famous thing that sports people do encounter, it's also something that people in general encounter. You know, they may have done a certain career for a period of time, and then they find themselves either out of a role or the industry has changed and they have to think of something else to do. How easy did you find it to think of something else to do?
I'm still looking. I'm 5 years on retirement, and I liken when you retire from sport is like leaving school. At school, at least you've had your education, you're fresh, everybody's in the same boat though from school, and you're young. And you're 16 or 18 or if you are. But when you retire from sport, right, what have you done for the last 20 years? Well, I've run around a cricket field. Right, what qualifications have you got? None. What experience have you got in the business world? None. So you then have to, it's sort of, as I said, leaving school, you go out and you say, right, I want to start a career in IT, or you want to start a career in employment, wherever it is you want to start your career after leaving school, you've got the whole life ahead of you. Now, when you retire from sport, I was 36, 37, you want a job. Well, you either go in at the beginning and you're doing the jobs that the 17, 18-year-olds are doing, or you try then go in halfway up, which you've got people that are applying for the same jobs that have been in the role for 20 years, that have got the experience, that have got the know-how, that have come in from somewhere else. And yes, you learn a lot of things about teamwork, about how you take care, about being successful, about dedication, and you can cross over. But you then need somebody to give you that chance of saying, right, then you've done it on a cricket pitch or the sporting field. How do you then transgress that into a role in business unless somebody gives you that chance? So I found it very... And what do you want to do? Because when you're at school, you leave school, you're young enough to try different ladders and say, right, I'm halfway up, but I don't enjoy that. I'm going somewhere else, and you're still below 20. Whereas you're 36, 37... and you're going on, well, you jump on one land and you think, well, I don't like that, I want to jump ships, you've still then got to find somebody else that's going to give you the opportunity to jump ships. So it is a very tricky crossover from professional sport into the working world.
And so you've just gone back to university to complete a master's degree in sports directorship. How is that turning out? And is it something, are you finding that leadership is something that can be taught, or is it something that you can draw on from your playing days?
It's both. Obviously, going back to university, well, going to university, because I never went to university. I did A-levels, but I didn't go to university. So to then say, right, then I want to further my education and get letters after your names to say, look, I would like to be a sporting director. And if you look at the sporting directors that are around, what qualifies them to be a sporting director? A lot of them were just good players, and they said, right, then we'll give you a role because we think you're a good lad or good person, and you've shown for a number of years that you know the sport. But what actually qualifies you to be a director? Not a lot. It's just you'll do. So to go back and say, right, what does it take to be director? What are the facets? What tools do I need in my tool bag to make sure that I can cope with the role? And then when you go for a job interview, they say, look, this is what I did on the sporting field, so I know how it is to be a sportsman, but I've also gone to university to say, right, what does it take to be behind the desk? So I think it's quite a crucial thing to do, to think about what you want to do. And the leadership element, there's a lot that you did it in your playing days, but there's a lot also that you learn, and every day is a school day, and no matter where you are, what you're doing, and just to be at school learning, you learn a lot more than you can learn so much more in a day than it could take you a year to find out if you're in the role.
Of course, one of the things you've been doing as well is coaching women's cricket. How's that been? I mean, have you found that the team dynamic is different from the men's game? Have you had to moderate your behaviour is something I'm interested to know.
Yeah, I mean, there's different levels. You've got to moderate your behaviour as a coach, from a player to a coach, you can't be that same person as that. You have to find your style and be yourself, but you're not now the laugher. You're now a leader. You're now trying to coach people how to play cricket, or they've entrusted you with their game, and that is a very important bond to build up, is the trust. And you have to individuals. You have to make sure that you monitor your style with individuals and change your style, not just in a male game, but in the female game as well. There'll be different relationships that you have to treat people differently, and the way you coach, the way you talk, the language that you use will change from player to player. And I don't see gender. I see, right, this is a cricket game, these are the skills. I coach cricket. I don't coach genders. And I treat each player as unique. And I think that is what you have to do as a coach. And as I said, they're giving you the most vital thing that they've got, and that's their game.
Talking of leadership strategies, we discussed earlier the leadership strategy of Michael Vaughan just talking nonsense to you, but he also admitted to being deliberately harsh on you to provoke your best performance. Is that right? And is that something that you've ever thought of considering yourself as an approach?
Yeah, again, so part of the university course, we did personal indexing. And what came out of that is that if you tell me I can't do it, I'll do it just to prove you wrong. So knowing what buttons to press on individual people is out of a good leader, and knowing their makeup. And there's times where I needed to be by myself, and people ask, so what are you doing tonight? So I'm going to sit in my room. Well, you did that last night. I said, yeah, but I'm bored of you all now. I've spent 7 hours with you on the pitch in the changing rooms. I need some time by myself. And just them to know that is great as a team, so they don't keep on asking, they don't pick on you for being an antisocial bar humbug. But Michael Vaughan being tough on me, yeah, because I'll then, okay, I'll prove you wrong. And it's like a red rag to a bull. So it's just another aspect of why he was such a good captain.
And I suppose that approach would not necessarily work with everyone, but he knew that it would work with you.
Yeah, and that's the art of knowing your team, knowing which buttons to push, making sure that each individual, A, feels worthy, that the clarity in their role, and then how do you get the best out of them?
And, of course, like every team, there must have been rivalries within that team. How do you deal with managing rivalries?
Again, it's down to different people and what makes them tick. And rivalry is healthy. You have to have rivalry. You have to have competition for places, because if you didn't, then you'd be a very you wouldn't be a very good team. If you didn't have people pushing on the door, and you're not constantly having to prove yourself, constantly having to improve, and the individuals at stake in that rivalry have to be managed. I mean, we had, during the 2005, we had what was called the Fab Four. There was myself, Steve Harmison, Andrew Flintoff and Simon Jones. And although we were all in the same role, same job, we wanted to take wickets, there wasn't that much rivalry, because we all wanted to get the job done and walk off the pitch as quick as possible. And we knew that in the role that one person would take wickets. And if Stephen was taking wickets, then it was my job to bowl for him. And he'll get the wickets, I won't go for runs, we get off the pitch. And then the other day or the next day, I'll be taking wickets, he wouldn't. But we wouldn't be jealous of each other, we just knew that the four of us, including Ashley Giles, but he was a spinner, so we knew that each of us would have our day in the sun at some point.
And then that was pre-agreed, was it?
Yeah.
You'd be taking wickets.
And everybody was sort of like, no hidden agendas, no nastiness about it. It was, right then, let's bowl as well as we can do, let's get off the pitch quickly, and we know that if we all did our job, then A, we're doing our role, and B, we'd stay in the team.
So that was the plan then. You now have experience coaching. Do you think the nature or dynamic of teamwork has changed over the years that you've been involved in cricket?
Cricket's a very individualistic game. The game has changed. I don't think teamwork changes that much in and around it, because if you're not a team, then you get into trouble. And I think the skill levels and the amount of, especially the batting, has changed dramatically in the introduction of T20. So everything's had to adapt and evolve around it. But then you see the great teams and teamwork saying, right, then what is the next shot? How do we combat that? How do we come, if the opposition did that, how do we, and the talking around it and making sure that everybody knows and everybody's, there's no secrets, and you move forward a lot better and you'll be a lot more successful.
And have you been able to apply that to some of the other teams that you've been on since leaving cricket? I mean, I think you were on a two-man team on Pointless Celebrities, for example, and there was the various celebrity TV shows, the MasterChefs and the like. How did that come into play there?
What I found is that when you speak to sports people, there's normally no hidden agendas, because you have to be honest with yourself, and if you're not honest, you don't move forward. And sports people can take criticism, because the coaches are basically criticising you or critiquing you and making you better, whereas some people can be precious and don't like to be challenged, don't like to be critiqued too much, whereas it's a natural day-to-day occurrence in sport. And in sport, the biggest thing that I've found, that in sport you've got instant clarity of whether you're doing a good job or a bad job. You know if you've won or lost. You know if you've won that point or lost that point. In business, it can take 12 months to get a contract, and it takes 12 months to it could longer. And that was so hard. And to go back to the point that people at half time, if you play at half time or if you're going for lunch, will critique what you're doing, will challenge what you're doing. And as a sportsman, you do it yourself, and you're encouraged to do it, because you're at the high performance. And if you want to perform, you have to be challenged. You want to enjoy that challenge. You have to be, right, how do I get better? And the only way to get better is reflect and build, challenge and conquer. And if you're not doing it yourself, or other people are not challenging you, then you're standing still.
So you're getting critique from the coach, you're getting critique from other players, no doubt. What about the media? Did criticism, when it happened, obviously you had some good positive highs in the media around 2005, but there were other times that weren't quite so high. When it's the media and maybe sort of the general public beyond that is providing some of the criticism, how easy is that to bear?
I don't really follow the media. As a player, I didn't need somebody to tell me that I'd bowled well or bowled badly, because I knew. So there's different people will either read it or not. Some people will read media all the time. Other people will read media when they've done well. Some people will just read media when they've done badly. Other people just ignore it. So there's different make. And I was I'll ignore it, because I don't need anybody else to tell me what I've done. I was very self-reflecting. I knew myself whether it was a good day or a bad day. So therefore, the opinions of the press didn't really matter.
And then you have been a bit of a pundit as well of late. So I'm going to ask you to indulge in some armchair punditry for now. What do you make of the current dynamic of the England team?
It's a little bit lost at the moment. We've got too many all-rounders. We haven't got enough stability in the batting. We're still looking for an opening partnership. We're looking for a number three. There's questions where Joe Root should be batting. There's 1-5 is, apart from Joe Root, is open for grabs. We're playing three wicketkeepers. We're playing three all-rounders. It's just not a very structured, I say structured, it's not a very classical structured team at the moment. It's nice to have all-rounders, but we haven't got the specialist players, and I say players, batters. I'm going to blame the batters, because I was a bowler. It's always the batter's fault. But 1-5, I think England are struggling with at the moment, which we are seeing in the West Indies. normally one of the all-rounders later on digs them out of a hole and scores some runs. And unfortunately, in the West Indies, that's not been the case. They've been shown up. Everybody was predicting 3-0, and it's currently 2-0 to the West Indies.
And if you had your hands on the machine, what would you do to make it better?
you need to find batters. And the knee-jerk reaction is everybody's saying, right, but where are the batters? And you have to be careful that you make changes for the right reason and not just making changes for changing's sake. Are the best five batters playing at the moment? Arguably, yes. But the problem is the majority of them need to bat at 5 and 6 or 7. Then we haven't got 1, 2, 3 or 4. Well, we've got a 4 in Joe Root, so we haven't got 1, 2, 3. And if you just change the team just for making changes, then you're not improving it. You're just doing a knee-jerk reaction. So it's quite a difficult conundrum. And it's not one that you can just say, we'll pick 3 opening bats. We haven't got them. So you can't change something if you haven't got the ingredients to change them with.
And do you think we'll ever see the kind of scenes that we saw back in 2005, an Ashes victory where the whole nation suddenly gets behind the England team?
I hope so. We've got the World Cup and the Ashes this year, so it's a massive year for English cricket. They put a big emphasis on white ball cricket 4 years ago, 5 years ago, because they were 4 years ago, they were absolutely shocking in the last World Cup. They didn't even get through the qualifying stages, so there was a massive emphasis put on white ball cricket, and England are currently now number one in the world at white ball cricket. So they have done what they said they were going to do. Unfortunately, at the moment, our test team isn't performing, but it wasn't in the cycle of cricket. Their big priority was the World Cup in England and to be a challenge for the title, in which they certainly are doing.
Let's go back to you, because you are, as we say, studying sports directorship. What do you want to do next? What would you like to see happen in your career next?
Wow, I'd like to win the lottery and retire and buy a little island and just live like a hermit, sure, away from everybody else. But love to be part or leading a successful team, whether that is in sport, whether that's in business. I would love to be able to say, right, then we went from here and we performed. And to me, that is the next challenge that I would like to succeed in, and being able to put the right people in the right places to make sure that the team is actually flying.
And maybe with the benefit of all the hindsight that you've accumulated over the years, what would you say that you know now that you'd wish you'd known perhaps when you were starting out on your career?
Are we now talking about spot fixing and betting so I could make some money?
Well, exactly. There's a few outcomes of games that would be useful to
them. Yes. I don't think I'd like to tell myself anything. I quite enjoyed my ride. I quite enjoyed learning and the highs and the lows. And I think if you went back and you gave yourself the answers, then you're robbing yourself of life's rich tapestry. I enjoyed my career. I enjoyed how it went. I don't think I have too many regrets. So I'd say I wouldn't tell myself, oh.
That's a nice endorsement of what's happened in your life, so that's good. What would be your top piece of career advice for people listening today?
Don't say should have done. Don't say what happened if I'd have done. Make sure that whatever you're going to do, whatever you're doing, give it that 100%. Make sure that there's no stone left unturned. And don't put limits on where you want to get to, because you put a ceiling on it, you can't get as high as you maybe could, because life is all about living. It's all about challenges, and there's no limitations.
Well, you kind of proved that, I think. thank you for that. So thanks for talking to us. Another inspirational Career Chats discussion. Make sure to tune in next week when our career advisor is apprentice-winning businessman Joseph Valente on Thinking Outside the Box. As we said before, you can listen on the Michael Page website and on Audioboom, Spotify and iTunes. So make sure you get the next episode by hitting the subscribe button on your player. And one last favour, if you've liked what you've heard so far, why not give us a 5-star rating on iTunes? It really does help us in spreading the word. But that's it from me. Thank you again, Matthew. Thanks for listening and see you next time.